Yo, so what do you guys want to do after the show? You want to get some food?
Yeah, yeah, we could we definitely eat food afterwards.
I'm down to do you know, late lunch, early dinner. Yo,
I
you
mean,
wanna...
I know I would like that, but it's just it seems like all the places around you are just, you know, so hipstery and uninviting. I'd really like something that felt more at like homey, like a family style restaurant where I felt like it was, you know, like a neighborhood bar and grill.
You guys want to go to the Bees? You guys fuck with the Bees, right?
Dude, I fuck with the Bees heavy.
I think they're great. Just, you know, to be totally honest, I love Applebee's.
You could say that I would recommend everyone who follows me, who listens to the show, should go to Applebee's.
All right, it's settled. We're going to Applebee's after the show. Yeah. 2-for-1 apps. I'm loving it. It's a fucking good family-friendly restaurant. Brendan, we're not recording this, right?
No.
Oh, yeah. Okay, this
we should say this, it on the episode.
Yeah, we should say
we
this
should
on the
probably
episode.
Probably tell people
yeah.
to go to Applebee's, yeah.
I mean, like, I don't like that because that would imply that we were getting paid by Applebee's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We aren't. We what? Just really love Applebee's.
I got an idea. What if we say we're going to Applebee's, but we fucking hate it and you shouldn't eat there?
Why would anyone say that,
what
though?
What the fuck is wrong?
What the fuck,
oh, that
Virgil?
Solves, that solves the problem.
I don't think you get the fucking point of this show. I don't know why we brought you on. You don't fucking...
I'm a problem solver. I'm a diplomat.
You think we're just negative against everything to be negative?
No. Part of critiquing the world is that you reify the parts of the world that are good, like Applebee's.
No, I mean, this is not native advertising at all.
No.
We just love Applebee's. That's like, I felt the need to get that off of my chest, even though I know we're now recording and that totally spontaneous conversation we had before was also captured, but I feel it needs to be said. I love the Bees.
You guys are doing like a tour, right, where you just go to regional Applebee's and record live while eating.
Yeah, but one of the best things about Applebee's is that you can be condescending to the wait staff and they love it.
They do,
it's great. There's never any sass, never any smarm. They always serve us with a smile, no matter what you say or do to them.
You can do whatever.
Yeah, I put out a lit cigarette in one of their faces one time, and they thanked me for
That's
it.
That's legal in an Applebee's.
Yeah, they're like Buckingham Palace guards.
Is that the Applebee's sketch?
Yeah. Applebee's.
Yeah.
I like that.
I also like to say that at the end of a natural conversation.
At every family deep meal, I toast with next year at Applebee's.
Well, now that we are recording, we got that, you know, totally natural, unplanned, unscripted conversation out of the way. Welcome everybody to I think our last show of 2016. I think we're gonna take a break till the holidays in the new year, but I would just like to welcome into the trap Kath Barbadoro.
Hi.
Who now enters the ultra elite echelon of two-time Chapo guests.
Yeah, it's truly an honor. I'm glad to be here in the mansion. There's a tiny dog.
Yep.
Which all rich people have.
Mm-hmm.
So you carry around in your purse, and it's good to be here.
Will actually knew he was going to be successful. That's why he had Mickey before the show. He bought Mickey on credit card. And now that we have the show, he's completely paid the dog off. No more payments.
He will sit in his desk. He will sit at his desk and menacingly stroke Mickey while imagining ways to get rid of the estate tax.
No, but Kath, you're visiting the city on a whirlwind comedy tour.
Mm-hmm. A tour of 3 dates, one of which I missed, so it's going great.
Well, Virgil and I saw you last night at Bushwick.
Mm-hmm.
You slayed, if you don't mind my saying.
Thank you.
No, it was a really good time. It was fun as hell. But you are back here on the East Coast because you're going home for the holidays, you know?
Yeah.
The last time we had you on was our Halloween episode, which was very spooky. And now we're having you back for our friendly and nice Christmas episode.
I mean, it's still kind of, if we're going to talk about where I'm going, it's still kind of spooky. Because we're going back to New Hampshire where, yeah, Virgil and Felix visited recently. Y'all hung out in my high school.
That's where Virgil and Felix first cut their bones on the campaign trail.
Yeah,
cut their bones?
We hang out at a lot of high schools.
Yeah, I wasn't part of the campaign trail. You just went to my high school.
New England is the creepiest part of the country, though, isn't it? It's like
Oh, it's so spooky. Yeah, it's H.P. Lovecraft.
Every corner has like an emaciated old man with hollow eyes going, "You can't get there from here."
See, that's what I expected. I expected a lot of spooky characters, but really it was just all simpletons.
It was entirely simpletons.
Yeah.
There are plenty of spooky simpletons.
That's very true.
Michael Myers isn't fucking breaking any IQ records.
The place we stayed at, it was owned by this...
Tilton, by the way. Tilton,
New Hampshire.
Yep.
It was owned by a lumbering simpleton named Anthony. And when we first came in there, he like told us how to use like the sinks and shit. but after that, he's like, "You're probably wondering what it's like to live up here. I met all types of people. I met John Kasich's wife. I met Jeb Bush's son. I even met Ted Danson."
I met him
at the diner. Not that many people see eye to eye with me because I'm about 6'5". But Ted Danson, I was actually looking up at him. And it was like, oh my God, this is the first primary in the nation. And it's like, fucking, this guy's voting.
Yeah,
these people should determine who the next president is every 4 years. There's no question about it.
Everyone in New Hampshire is like, you know that Mr. Show sketch where the guy makes a micronation? And he's just like,
"Get off my land!
Get off my land!" Like, over and over again. He goes to the grocery store and is in awe and is like, sizzling steaks and creamy cakes. That's everyone in New Hampshire. They're all just, their only political interest is getting people off their land. That is all they care about. I've had like multiple friends accidentally trespassing and have been held at gunpoint by like New Hampshire weirdos. it's a nightmare.
The other thing, like, so this guy owned like a bunch of cottages, like vacation rentals by some lake up there in Tilton. I guess there's a big lake in that area. And we had like a problem in the second or third day about heat or something, and he, correct me if I'm wrong, Felix, but that guy had this like weird Manos the Hands of Fate relationship. His handyman. And he was just lurking around. And we like brought up some problem with the heat. And he's like, "Oh, yeah, it's that idiot, that piece of shit."
Yeah, there was some disturbing sub-dom relationship between Anthony and the lesser simpleton. And like every, like, very basic
there's
problem.
Something so creepy about like dumb people fucking each other. Yeah. It's so spooky.
Yeah, I mean, like, there would be very basic problems with that. Like, the electricity wouldn't work or something. And Anthony would be like, "Yeah, looks like I gotta make John sleep outside again." It was like, "Can you guys just do this on your own time? Like, can you not have the reason for punishing you, simpleton? Can you have that unrelated to our living conditions?" Weirdo.
Stop being so sex negative, okay? They were just expressing their love.
I didn't want to participate.
Well, it's like, we're not tourists. We don't need the whole song and dance where you abuse this man in front of us.
Yeah. Wait a minute. I thought the people in New Hampshire only fucked holes in maple trees.
I mean, that's essentially what the assistant was. He was just like a walking maple tree. he would come in and be like, every time you need the warm water, it's off in the winter." Like, I don't know how they have like police. I don't know how they collect taxes up there.
They don't.
They don't.
Yeah. They actually don't.
No, yeah, they don't have a state sales tax, right?
No, they have no sales tax. And that's like actually one of the weirder things about Tilton is like the entire economy in Tilton is just people coming up from Massachusetts to buy shit because it's cheaper there because there's no sales tax. So like that is the entire economy of Southern New Hampshire is just other dumb people from a different state.
They're just coming to get like cartons of cigarettes, Red Sox hats, Patriots gear, and
Boston B calf tattoos.
There's no
my favorite thing about New Hampshire is the fact that they have a gig absurdly gigantic House of Representatives.
It's the largest employer.
So, like, the only people who run for it are just, like, local nutcases.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised,
so, like,
if the guy he stayed with was
one. Every other state would just be, like, a weirdo in the library you try not to make eye contact with. In New Hampshire, they're in the state legislature.
Yeah, John was a state senator.
Yeah.
He was actually the president of the state senate. Like,
I saw a guy like that in D.C. or at the RNC in Cleveland. He spoke at the Alex Jones rally. He was the guy who got in trouble a little bit later for saying that Hillary should be executed. He was sort of like, he was a state legislature for New Hampshire, and he was like a dark Bernie Sanders in that he was a New York guy who moved to New England and became political. So he's like, hey. Yeah, he's like a fucking Sopranos guy going, the freaking Hillary Clinton over here, she's no good.
Wait, are you doing Bernie or that guy?
Hey, forget about it.
New Hampshire and Vermont are very much like these fucked up mirror images.
But there's
of
kind
each
of a yin yang thing going
exactly.
on between Vermont and New Hampshire, because Vermont is like very crunchy. It's like the hippie state.
Yeah, they're both like very. They're very like individual focused. Like, they definitely, no one wants anyone on their land. That has been established. But like, as Vermont is left, New Hampshire is right.
I mean, but it's a very specific kind of right wing.
Yeah,
it's sort of a libertarian. It's like a libertarian state.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, but that's bullshit. They supported Trump.
They did, but that's
there was nothing doctrinarily libertarian about the Trump campaign, which goes to show that every fucking guy who said they're libertarian and voted for Trump, no, they like the rhetoric of it, but at the end of the day, they want somebody with a fucking gun and state authority to shoot, like, the teens on their lawn or whatever.
Yeah, like,
they don't really care about liberty.
Because you need me, Springfield. Your guilty conscience may force you to vote Democratic. But deep down inside, you secretly long for a cold-hearted Republican to lower taxes, brutalize criminals, and rule you like a king.
The main difference is just that they're not religious. Like, okay. That's more of the difference than, like, they espouse libertarianism because they're not evangelical.
Well, they are religious. They just worship the old ones.
Yeah.
In fact, the only religious person that me and Felix met was John Kasich.
He's not really religious in like a normal sense.
No.
He sort of made up his own thing.
He worships a god made of discarded bean cans that he is.
Well, we saw him at
railroad junkyard.
He worships the hobo god, and paradise is Rock Candy Mountain.
Yeah.
But
we saw him at a town hall.
Lemonade
the cigarette trees.
The bluebirds sing.
I mean, like, so as far as I could ascertain, like, the New Hampshire state motto is, am I being detained?
Yes.
And if you want to declare your candidacy for the state house or state senate, you have to, like, it's ceremonial. You have to get caught, like, looking at porn in a library. Get into an argument with the, call the fucking cops. I don't care. That's how you declare it. It's very traditional. But so, like, these people... There are some normal people there, and that was like Kasich's constituency when we went to see him.
Yeah, but he was not saying normal things.
No, he's fucking out of his mind.
He was out of his gourd. He was telling just bizarre stories, and one of them was like, when I say he was the only religious person we met, it was the first time I actually heard religious shit my entire time there, and it was Kasich talking about The Voice telling him to run for president. Yeah. And Felix or Nick, one of you guys, explained to me, like, oh, that's like a god thing. But now I think it's, no, that's like an actual
voice. No, just schizophrenia.
Yeah.
I mean, the Kasich thing was bizarre. He started out telling this very David Lynchian story where he's like, you know, back when I was a kid, we took care of each other. And there, I took a pony ride and my mom paid too much for it. And I asked her why she did that. And she pointed to the boy with a black eye and said, John, some people aren't as lucky. And then 2 weeks later, I saw the man who owned the pony, and he was our milkman.
It was like, no, that's word for word, the story. It made no sense.
Word for word what it was.
We were all baffled by
and
it.
And like all
that's
the all
fucking
these
spooky, man.
All these fucking oafs in the crowd were like, wow.
Just like nodding their head.
Yeah,
well, they probably...
You know, when I was a young man, I would used to take the garbage out at my local soda shop, and there was this horrifying monster hung around by the dumpster.
They're all used to it. Their sanity is zero in game terms.
Well, the town I grew up in, we had the state mental hospital, and like in the 80s, they just let everyone out of it, and that was like...
Reaganomics.
Yeah, that was like a big constituency of my town, was just these raving lunatics that would wander around downtown. And all my friends worked
How was your high school job at Winnie's Diner, by the way?
That's exactly it. All my friends worked at this bagel place, and these weirdos would come in. I remember there was one, his name was, everyone called him Blind Deaf Jim, and he would alternatively pretend to either be blind or deaf, and would switch it up every once in a while. And one time he walked in, and my friend went, "Hey, it's Blind Deaf Jim," and he went, "I heard that."
So Kasich, the most bizarre thing that Kasich did was he talked about going to the gym.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, my wife's coming to town, and so, you know, I got to the gym. I had to get on a leg press machine. I think he was implying that he was going to fuck, but it was like, what does that have to do with the movements of sex, like doing the leg press machine?
Also baffled.
And then, like, this guy, like, a guy walks up to him and stands over him while he's on the leg press machine and like asks him about taxes. And I think
that just happens to everyone who goes to the gym in New Hampshire. It doesn't have anything to do with him being running for president.
I think the implication was that it was a gay thing.
Yeah. I mean, just the entire Kasich event was sentences that trailed off, stories that left you more confused. There was a Kasich boy.
The perfectly smooth Kasich boy. As Nick said.
That's a good nickname.
We were there with Nick Mullen.
There was a perfectly smooth 10-year-old wearing like Kasich branded Under Armour. and they like give him a mic. It was like, Governor, my dad is the coach of the wrestling team. He wants me to be smooth.
What does a perfectly smooth 10-year-old mean?
I don't know.
Nick took a photo of this kid. I think it's on his Twitter if you go back to January.
Oh god.
And so like he asked Kasich this bizarre question about winning Michigan, and Kasich launches in this rambling joke about kidnapping two football coaches, but it just never goes anywhere.
Everyone in the audience is just like, I know all of this sounds inane, and it was totally inane, but everyone in the audience is just rocking back and forth.
They love it. Yes. They love it. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant just because they're all insane.
But it's soothing. Like the Kasich voice is soothing to a certain number of New Hampshireites, and I don't know what it is.
Back to the smooth boy. I'm just imagining like a seal, basically.
Oh boy, I look at you. You're smooth. To answer your question, as governor, I would let your dad have wrestling practice at the governor's mansion, and then one day at the White House. All kids should be smooth.
Everyone, if you want to see a photo of this, go bug Nick Mullen about it.
And just okay, don't even DM him. Just at Nick Mullen and say, I want all your pictures of smooth boys. He'll know what you're talking about. Don't do that. Don't do that. Nick to get bothered by the FBI again.
I don't want Nick to leave Twitter again.
Nick's
just going to be
now that he can't be on Facebook because of the balls.
Nick's going to be on a first name basis with like his FBI guy. It's going to be one guy assigned to the Mullen case.
He got kicked off Facebook because of Christopher Lambert's balls.
Yes.
Yeah, if you watch the quick side note here, if you watch the film Fortress, early on there's a sex scene where Christopher Lambert is like actually having sex with a woman, and you can see his balls. It's amazing.
It's so cool.
Well, hold on a minute. 50-year-old film way. Have his dick taped to his abdomen. That's the only other possibility.
Dude, he was fucking.
I just think it's because he's like, isn't he Belgian or something?
Yeah. In every film in Europe, like even like nature documentaries, they have to show full penetration. That was in the Maastricht Treaty.
Well, actually, I will. So we've spent a lot of time reminiscing about New Hampshire, where you grew up, Kath, which is sort of this like the weird conservative bubble in the otherwise blue Northeast.
Yeah, but deep south of the Northeast.
Yeah,
as
but now you live in Austin, which is sort of like the liberal bubble in the otherwise deeply red state of Texas. So what's that like? What's Austin like? You had a bit about what it's like living in Texas in your set last night.
I did?
Yeah.
what was it about?
Oh, it was about abortions.
Oh, yeah. They're taking them away. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's absolutely a fucking dystopia. Like, it's terrible. The one sort of consolation about it is because it's the capital, all of these fucking assholes have to live in a city where they are just openly hated by everyone, which is kind of cool. But yeah, I think it like the nice thing about it, and there's a couple cities in the South that I think have this. Atlanta's sort of like this too, where like if you are not like a super religious, insane gun nut, then that's where you have to move. So like everybody moves there. And so it's like, I don't know. That's like kind of nice.
Don't you think you need to get out of your bubble though? And you know, we're all just in an echo chamber, right? I mean, isn't that kind of a condescending thing to say to people, especially if they're like, you know, in an otherwise like shithole state?
Yeah, like I mean, it depends on who you're talking to, because I feel like I know a lot of people who, if they left the bubble, would probably get their asses kicked like right away. So yeah, I don't know. I've done comedy outside.
Well,
the bubble.
I never understand what that's supposed to mean. Are they genuinely saying that you should go amongst the, you know, you should be like the Narodniks, you know, the fucking populists in Tsarist Russia, and like go to the mirrors and like talk to the peasants, that kind of thing? That seems incredibly condescending to me.
I think especially people mean
especially if the unsaid assumption is that you can like talk people out of their beliefs through your amazing rhetorical skills and logic and shit like that.
Hey, let's send Jonathan Chait there.
Yeah,
practice what you preach.
Because I honestly don't think that there's anything more condescending about saying fuck those fucking reactionary hillbilly dipshits and saying, no, I can talk them out of it. I watched every episode of The West Wing.
It's all for the benefit of the person going there, I think. It's like it's like the same reason people fucking study abroad in a third world country and are like, it's so colorful here. Like,
take pictures of kids that you make your Tinder profile.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just do that with a bunch of fucking fat Confederate flag wearing like biker assholes and make that your Tinder profile.
I'm actually writing a book where I spend 6 months of the year in a red state, and then I spend the other 6 months of the year in Africa. And it's called Between Two Worlds.
It's a good name.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Well, Matt, I think Matt's right, and it is the fucking Sorkin delusion that will prove our point by logic, and then they'll all be voting for Hillary. They'll all be voting for DNC.
To the detriment of that idea, like Bernie Sanders did fucking great in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because like all these lunatics were like, I've been waiting for Harringtonian socialism. It was because like he explained his program in very simple, understandable, direct, blunt terms. And also because he's racist.
Yeah.
As opposed to Hillary, who like all her events there, she was just probably like, like putting up graphs about how she's going to use fucking an app to get people the earned income tax credit, which like people don't respond to. People
and then she would, then she would vomit for 50
minutes
and pass out.
She would fall down a manhole,
and then they would come up a different manhole with like big sunglasses on, going, "I feel great, everybody."
Yeah. I mean, she actually liked New Hampshire because she could get fentanyl everywhere, which is good because she has rickets and several other painful conditions.
Well, but that's the thing that's like what's undergirding all of these fantasies. Of, you know, of reaching out to people who didn't vote the way you wanted them to on some sort of retail basis. Part of it is like the self-congratulatory idea that you are somehow fucking brilliant enough to, you know, talk people out of their beliefs. But I think even undergirding that is the fact that like the contemporary Democratic Party has basically decided that that politics is not a sphere that encompasses the economy, right? Like the market is a thing of its own, and all that politics can do is sort of like, you know, trim at the edges of it and sort of ameliorate some of its very worst effects. But the market is going to do what the market wants to do. But the thing is, like people's experience of their lives is them being shaped at every point by economics. Like that's the thing, that's the oppressive force in their life. And they would like very much to be able to fucking, you know, do something about it. But when the progressive quote unquote party has explicitly made policy around the idea that you can't do anything about economics, well, why the fuck would anybody bother voting? When you basically told them that voting isn't gonna affect the one thing that does the most to impact their lives. And so instead of telling people, hey, we can do something about this, No, I'm going to bring the cast of The West Wing in, and we're going to appeal to your sense of decency and what the presidency should be and all That's of like these the, abstract the, bullshit notions that don't impact anybody's lives.
She did that. She deployed did, well, yeah, the West
Martin
Wing.
Sheen made like a personalized video for the faithless yeah. electors.
Jeb Bartlett
and
from
it worked.
New Hampshire.
She's president now. Yeah. It's amazing.
I love the idea that like that's how you flip Republicans. Like the one group of libs that appeal to Republicans are fucking actors, but not acting as the characters they like, just as their real dumb selves.
Yeah.
Let me posit this. Maybe maybe Bernie does have an appeal because he is railing against the same people they hate. So he's going against bankers and insurance executives and greed. And it's like, yeah, they hate those people too for like slightly different reasons. But
yeah, I think like growing up in New Hampshire, like the main... the central political issue is like personal autonomy and like freedom in that sense. Like that is the motivating thing of just like fucking mind your own business. Don't bother me. Like even though it is like conservative, it's New Hampshire is generally pretty good about like reproductive rights and stuff just because that's so like invasive to them. And that's not the type mm-hmm. of conservatism that they're interested in. So like when people come and posit themselves as anti-establishment, anti-like that gets them. Like they like someone like Bernie, they like someone like Trump for the same reasons, even though.
And I think that could be so easily harnessed because totally. Like I said, in most people's day-to-day lives, what force is more oppressive to them? The federal government, who they might never interact with other than, you know, when they fill out their taxes in their entire year, or their fucking boss? Which one of those two people, the president or their boss, is telling them like how long they have to work and what the conditions are that they're going to work under. I mean, that is their life. That's their day-to-day life. And it's your fucking boss who's telling you what to do. And if because like socialism could so easily be refocused on that. And then all of those like native ideas about don't tread on me and like personal freedom could be redirected towards the people who actually do fuck up your personal freedom on a day-to-day basis.
Right. It's sort of like you guys were talking about in your conspiracy theory episode where like these ideas could be repurposed to some sort of productive end because it's like, oh, there are a small group of people in power who control everything. That's not an idea that's like particularly opposed to a lot of like the political beliefs that we subscribe to. It's just that they think that small group of people are reptilians. Like that's the only difference.
they may be, but I mean, I think just, you know, like I said, I think this is our last show for the year until 2017, but... Basically, what it all boils down to is that it should just be said over and over again to the tune of your favorite song, anything that you can make it fit in, Bernie would have won.
Yeah.
Say it. Oh, this is now violence, though. This is harassment now. Mm-hmm. If you say
it's
that to people
now.
Online. If you say Bernie would, I'm just saying, keep it up, folks.
Yeah.
You heard it here first. Continue the sexist harassment.
all of the best truths are simple. And fuck Kevin Drum, Bernie would have won. Yeah. That's the new anthem for 2017.
Well, my favorite thing about that article is like he's one of these, you know, neoliberal shitheads who worship at the altar of data. And even though they just saw that whole model blow up in the presidential election, and his Bernie wouldn't have won article is basically, I mean, I don't have any reason to say this. I have literally no backing, but he would have lost because like when I see Republicans, they make me piss myself. So clearly they would have made him piss himself.
By the way,
able to overcome that.
If you don't know who Kevin Drum is, look him up on Twitter and look at his profile picture and banner picture. Because
yeah.
It is honestly like one of the weird, like he's wearing what he looks to be nude from the waist down. Yeah.
Deeply
and
troubling.
He's like cradling, he's like spooning his cat. It's very odd.
Isn't he like lying on a floor?
Yeah.
It's
very weird.
He's doing like a pinup girl pose.
Yeah.
And he's got two separate photos from this photo series. One for his avatar and one for his banner.
Oh man.
I was gonna reply to something inane he wrote with his avatar, but then I got weirded out.
I mean, if someone made a Kevin Drum 2017 calendar with just like different pictures of him, I would absolutely buy that. Just as long as he wasn't the one selling it,
but
I would buy it.
He's a blogger for Mother Jones, but like the only things he writes are like that. Like they're just like it's just him mitigating wrong things he said 2 months ago, which is like all right, how many Kevin Drumheads are there out there?
This needs to be
self-referential.
Who's like a philosophy professor and epic logic guy who thinks that Kevin Drum is basically always right.
Mother Jones
does. There's at least one.
Mother Jones does still have like probably a big subscription base despite the complete just dunderheads who run that fucking outfit.
Well, that Shane guy,
Shane Bauer,
does like good investigative journalism.
Yeah.
And their actual journalism is good, but everything that isn't journalism is like Clara Jeffrey talking about how to throw pennies at beggar children and shit.
No, you bring up the Shane Bauer thing, and like he had that big exposé where he got a job working as a private prison guard, and it was really good.
Great.
Yeah,
and
it
got a lot of press, and like okay, and they got a lot of burn for that one, and rightly so, but then almost like immediately after it came out, Clara Jeffrey was like, thanks so much for all this, but like, you guys, you got to know, like, it just takes money to do this, and like, we need your support, and like, you know, we don't make money on advertising, like, it cost us $300,000 to put together that whole private prison expo or whatever. And I'm like, well, that's great. How much are you fucking paying yourself and Ben Dreyfuss?
Yeah.
Like, you could hire 6 journalists if you just quit.
Look, I'm sorry, but you do Ben nothing Dreyfuss of value. Needs that money so that he can go to Soul Cycle class and then shit himself and cry and then do 5,000 tweets in a row about how people need to die.
Can we talk about what Clara Jaffery brings to Mother Jones? Because yesterday, I remembered the best tweet of 2016. And it was when Clara Jeffrey posted a picture of Anita Hill.
Oh my God!
Meeting Ivanka Trump, and Clara Jeffrey goes, if I had to interpret Anita Hill's hands right now, she'd be saying, girl, don't come at me with that BS.
It's important to note, girl was spelled with a U.
Yeah, like, girl spelled bad. With a U. Yeah.
And a very good Twitter search to do is Clara Jeffrey's Jeffrey plus Holla.
Or that one or sister.
All the time. But my all-time favorite one. We were reminiscing about this online the other day, and it still blows my mind, is when she was fetishizing the Baton Rouge in the iconic photo, who is, you know,
it was,
being
it was
overwhelmed
a young
by
woman.
These cops and,
yeah.
you know, riot gear. And she's like, and this was when there was the rioting in Charleston, and she goes, oh, I wish she could be there. And people are like, well, what? You think she's magical? What the fuck is wrong with you?
I wish we could summon her.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like she was a god. Yeah, like she's a fucking voodoo priestess.
So like Claire.
She's a Pokemon, exactly. Yeah. And she's like, I'm sorry, but that picture is so powerful. She froze those cops.
It's a picture.
It's a fucking
it's a still picture.
It's not moving.
Like, there's video of that incident. The cops run up and grab her. They don't stop.
Yeah,
that was because that moment in time was frozen by a technology we have known as photography.
Well, then also, Ezekiel Kweku, friend of the show and recent guest, he jumped in and he was trying to explain to her, like, do you see how as a black person I look at this and think you're essentializing and kind of insulting in a way by saying you think that we're magical superheroes who should be summoned to places to make you feel good? And she goes, and Clara Jeffrey replies, he was he laid it out in several tweets, and she replies, no, you don't understand. I'm saying I like her. I'm saying she's magical to me and she's a superhero. And he's like, that's what I'm saying is bad. And then she did another thing to everybody. She tweeted to everybody. She goes, okay, some folks misinterpret it. I'm saying she's a superhero who's magical and I love her.
Yeah. So Clara lives in the movie The Help. And
speaking of all this stuff, your guest Ricky Rawls, he recently has been talking a lot about this like white idea that white ally idea that like black people are magical, and he just like, if you're interested at all in this, go read his Twitter feed because it's very very illuminating.
So Clara Jeffrey gets paid $70 million a year by Mother Jones
to make them look bad, I guess.
Well, like now that we got on this topic, I do want to shout out a really good article that came out today in Paste Magazine. It's a critique of Mother Jones, and they're just basically their whole editorial embrace of like just this god-awful tepid neoliberalism that of course is papered over with by, you know, Clara appropriating the slang of like 20-year-old like woke high school kids. It's by Naomi LaChance. It's in Pace magazine right now. We'll link to it in the show info.
Here he comes now, the big ham.
I'm Mr. White Christmas. I'm Mr. Snow. I'm Mr. Icicle. I'm Mr. Ten Below. Friends call me Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow in my clutch. I'm too much.
He's Mr. White Christmas. He's Mr. Snow. He's Mr. Icicle. He's Mr. Ten Below.
Friends call me Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow in my clutch.
He's too much.
I never wanna know a day that's over 40 degrees. I'd rather have a 30, 20, 10, 5, and then it freezes.
He's Mr. White Christmas. He's Mr. Snow.
That's right.
He's Mr. Icicle. He's Mr. Ten Below.
Friends call me Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow in my clutch. Too much.
Too much.
Now we've had a fun time, and I talked earlier about getting out of the bubble, and I like to think that one of the things we've done on the show this year is help people, you know, our listeners, get out of the bubble, get out of the echo chamber through a little feature called the Chapo Reading Series. You know, that's how I break out of my bubble. Is I read from, you know, intelligent conservative authors who, like, you know, I may disagree with them profoundly on many issues, but, you know, like, I still think it's good that you have to, like, you know, you have to respect everyone.
Hey, you know, at the end of the day, we're all people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, some of us are people.
Some of us are magic. Some of us are superheroes.
But
yeah, so what you're really saying is that, like, it's important politically to hate read things that make you angry.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm saying what you need to break out of the echo chamber, the bubble, is the right mix of sadism and masochism to expose yourself to things like we do. And to close out this year on the reading series, I have I'm dipping back in now to a little novel ripped from the headlines known as True Allegiance by Ben Shapiro. Fans of the show, you may remember we read from this during our election night live show. You can go back and listen to, I read from the preface and the first chapter. However, I feel like we should catch people up because many of you, it was probably too traumatic to go back and listen to that whole election night show. But I want to catch you up on this, because this is Ben Shapiro's novel. It's a page-turning thriller ripped from the headlines called True Allegiance. I just want to read real quick now from this basically will sum up what the book is. This is from the review of it in the Independent Journal Review. It just summarizes, it follows these characters over the course of this frighteningly close-to-home narrative. The characters include Brett Hawthorne, a military hero who knows more than he should.
Yes.
Soledad Ramirez, a California rancher who makes herself an enemy of the state. Levon Williams, a power-hungry race hustler in Detroit.
Oh, my God.
Ellen Hawthorne, a top aide to a beleaguered border state governor. And Mark Prescott, a self-aggrandizing president, propel the sprawling story of a terror attack and its aftermath. Now, when we first read from this, just to catch you up, I read the preface, which is a description of a mother and daughter dying as the George Washington Bridge is bombed by terrorists and collapses on top of them. And then I read from chapter one, which is Brett Hawthorne. And just to remind you, I just want to read this one of Shapiro's descriptions of the character Brett Hawthorne. Hawthorne was a bear of a man, 6'3" in his bear.
He was a bear, all right. line.
6'3" in his bare feet. Okay, bear of a man, 6'3" in his bare feet. This is excellent writing. And 215 pounds in his...
Hey, I'm hard. It's good writing.
This is exactly how all fan fiction starts.
He was a bear of a man, 6'3" in his bare feet, and 215 pounds in his underwear, with a graying blonde crew cut and a face carved of granite.
Now you know what you're jacking off to. Continue.
He had plenty of smile lines. He just didn't like showing them to people unless he knew them. This is chapter one. Brett is behind enemy lines in Afghanistan, but then there's a long section where he reminisces back to his childhood, going to a predominantly black high school in the south side of Chicago, where a bully tries to get him to say the N-word, and he uses his clever wits to escape fighting. But he learns street smarts along the way.
Well, at least let him hear a little bit of how Ben writes black people.
And yeah, it's really good.
Wait, I can't wait. I mean,
it's like how Clara writes black people.
Yeah, I'm getting to that. It is incredible.
It is incredible. It's I still have not read my copy of it, but I'm looking forward to it.
I don't want to read it. I want to be surprised every time I get another fresh gem.
So we've already introduced the character of Brett Hawthorne. He's the youngest general in American history. He's a tough, take no prisoners, no bullshit kind of guy. Carved from granite, 6'3", slightly hairy, just enough hair.
Uncircumcised.
Uncut. Okay, now I'm going to, like I said, every chapter alternates one perspective between these characters. So I'm now introducing in chapter two, President Prescott.
What is with this fucking wag?
Sorry, all the chapter heads look like the sort of like cutouts in a ransom letter. It's excellent book design.
Yeah. That's how we know it's a dystopia.
Interior limo. President Prescott is smoking crack and having gay sex.
Well, yeah, you joke, but guys, you'll never guess who Ben has based this character on.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is chapter two, Washington, Dateline, Washington, D.C. We simply can't pay for it, sir. White House Chief of Staff Tommy Bradley was standing over the president's desk in the Oval Office, a sheaf of budget papers in his hand. Crumbled, wrinkled papers covered in red notes. The numbers just didn't add up. And President Mark Prescott didn't care. Listen to me, Tommy, said the president. My reelection relies on our ability to secure funding for this action. You know that. I know that. The polls show it. We don't have a choice in the matter. Tommy gritted his teeth. He knew Prescott was right. The president had been dropping precipitously in the polls. His critics blamed his policies for widespread inflation and unemployment.
We had so much of that under Obama. The fucking inflation was crazy. I remember last time I went to the grocery store, I had to bring a fucking wheelbarrow full of cash.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have a secret family that I abandoned because of the budget deficit. It just made my life untenable. It's too hard to raise a kid with this deficit so out of control.
So, you know, the podcast makes $30,000 a year, but in pre-Obama money, that's like $20,000.
Yeah.
Prescott was deathly afraid of becoming Jimmy Carter. And he was right on the precipice of having his worst fears realized. When Mark Prescott ran for president, he didn't know what he'd be inheriting. He was no babe in the woods. He was a hardened ideologue, a product of the Chicago machine.
A rock-hard ideologue.
The hand-picked protege of the power brokers. But he hadn't quite contemplated the nature of the country he'd be handed once elected. And then he goes on to just like basically rehash. His opponent, General Hart, had been a militant and boring old man. It also didn't hurt that his presidential predecessor had been an unpopular member of Hart's party. Again, this is Ben is like masterfully shading, you know, what's going on with these characters.
What a creative mind.
I love how like before every line it's like, but he didn't care about the budget deficit. Right, and then the next line is the president going, I don't care about the budget deficit.
This is a window into how Ben views the world, and this is what he really believes about the fucking deficit and shit. The president just said, I don't care that we can't pay for it. Just spend the money on
print more money. Make it bigger.
Spend the money on the thing, which is how he writes it. I need the money for this action.
Yeah, you don't know what he's funding.
Now you guys joke, but this chapter goes on to say that, like, President Prescott, he just knew he had to end his predecessor's wars, no matter the cost, and then spend all the money on like food stamps and big government programs. Literally, this is I'm not I'm not. This is almost verbatim. And then he's like, it's all about he's going to create, borrow money from China to create like a new deal, basically, and that's how he's going to save his administration. And then he's going to go. Okay, so he's going to go on TV to like announce the new thing. So the new socialist program that is not socialism. Wink. Because his Prescott always enjoyed this part of the process, the part where the pretty girl hovered over him with a makeup brush and her palette spread before her. He could finally relax. Everything would be on the teleprompter, and nobody knew how to read from a teleprompter like Mark Prescott.
Oh, yeah. Also, like, you know what? Fuck him for that. Fuck him for the fucking teleprompter thing, because I remember, I mean, all of us sensible libs spent 8 years being just infuriated by the teleprompter thing because, as we all knew, every fucking president in history used the goddamn teleprompter. But little did we know that that teleprompter thing was slowly being internalized by the entire Republican electorate, because I cannot not believe that a big portion of the reason that Trump was so appealing to the mass of idiot Republican primary voters is that he clearly did not use a teleprompter.
No.
If there's ever been the only politician basically in history who'd never used a teleprompter is fucking Donald Trump. And I mean, how many people like watched him stammer through an insane stream of consciousness and thought, yeah, he sounds like his brain is degenerating from Creutzfeldt Jakobson. He does not have a fucking teleprompter.
I mean, yeah, how would you write out on a teleprompter, like, folks, believe me, I beat Rosie. You wouldn't write out just that insane bullshit on there.
Sorry, a little bit more before the tele. So he says, Mr. President, said Bradley, you're on in two. Bradley shooed away the makeup artist, a hot number in her mid-20s. Exactly the kind of girl Prescott's wife hated.
Also, Prescott didn't like her because he was a gay homosexual.
As Bradley was about to push her out the door of the Oval Office, Prescott laughed. Tommy, just calm down. We've done this 1,000 times, he said. Let the young lady stay. Then he winked at her. She fluttered her eyelashes.
Just to be clear, Ben Shapiro's had sex maybe once in his life.
Yeah. I don't even want to say the full.
Yeah, he has one kid, therefore he had sex once.
He had sex once. He famously wrote an article bragging about being a virgin while he was in law school.
Yeah. Is there a sex scene in this book?
Not yet. Not yet.
I mean, that description
of Brett Hawthorne was close enough.
President Obama put his stuff in her ass.
I want to get to two more characters here. So real quick. So President Prescott goes on TV and like announces that he's going to do socialism. Okay. So the next chapter is Soledad, and there's not that much that's funny in here to read from. But basically, Soledad Ramirez is just like Ben Shapiro's version of Sarah Palin as like a white Latina, basically.
Yeah.
In this, she's a rancher from Central Valley, California, and like the government shut off her water or something, and she had to like shut off her family's farm and laid off the immigrant who worked for her. And then there's a description about how the immigrant who worked for her but like came here the right way, and she was trying to sponsor his citizenship, had to move to inner city Los Angeles, and his son Juan was killed when he wouldn't join a gang. And that's when Soledad is like, I'm going to fight the government.
All because of the government's damn water rights.
She decides to fight the government and actually pulls off an act of domestic terrorism by blowing up some government office on the weekend, but makes sure and very careful not to kill anybody. So like, but Ben is 100% in favor of this, which is funny. And then there's this,
that's
like
what
sort
the weatherman did.
This is, yeah, exactly. Yeah. She's like a conservative weather gal. And there's like, it devolves into this like Bundy Ranch style standoff between her and the federal government. Okay, this is the money shot here. Now we get to the chapter Levon. You'll remember from the description, Levon was the race hustler.
Yeah.
Okay, this is
also a great Elton John song.
Yeah. He just got back from the hip hop factory he owned.
This chapter begins. Detroit was a shithole, but it was his shithole. That's the way Levon Williams thought of it.
I want to hear more about guys' shitholes from Benjamin.
He'd grown up in this shithole right near 8 Mile Road, a long stretch of street separating Detroit from Oakland County.
It's like a description from Wikipedia.
It gets better. Detroit was 85% black with a medium household income of $27,000 per year. Oakland County was 77% white with a median income of $65,000 per year. end up on the wrong side of the street, and you could wind up carjacked, mugged, or beaten and left for dead. The emergency response time measured 25 minutes from City Hall to downtown Detroit.
Crib from Wikipedia.
Yeah. So basically, Levon owns a barbershop that's a front for his crack cocaine dealership. I'm not kidding.
Oh, my God.
No, this is great.
Crack, because, you know, the drug of choice. Well, in 2016,
very popular.
America.
Well, no, Ben acknowledges this. Ben acknowledges this. He
because
says
because he watched New Jack City when he was a kid. And it's never.
No,
left
it said Levon's shop was a barber shop. It didn't stick out on the road. The clientele was mainly older black men. The younger men didn't like to hang out there for fear they'd be sucked into Levon's orbit. But the older men knew what was happening in the community. More importantly, they knew where the bodies were buried, often literally. The clientele didn't spend a lot of money. Then again, they didn't need to. In the back room behind the swivel chairs, Levon and his crew shuttled crack cocaine. That drug had gone out of style in the mid-1990s thanks to the federal crackdown on crack dealers.
Say and then, crack
and then,
again.
The federal crackdown on crack dealers. And then, like, in
that's
and
good writing. Yeah. Excellent. He's cracked twice in one sentence like that.
And then yeah. he does an aside. That's what we call
Bell-Lette.
He does an aside after the crackdown on crack dealers. He does an aside in Levon's character's head, I guess, or like in this omniscient third person narration. Black politicians had been the biggest advocates of putting crack dealers on different footing than powder cocaine at the time. Nobody wanted to deal crack anymore, but Levon catered to a select population.
The hipsters.
Yeah, he's a boutique crack dealer.
Crack, ironically.
Pajama boy
like,
walked
they
up.
They wear like New Balance and starter jackets and smoke crack.
They look like Adam from Cumtown. And if Adam Friedland, and pajama boy, walked up to Levon and said, "One crack, please." Levon thought in his head. I get to blame white flight on racism when really it's a consequence of market forces.
Adam Friedland walks into the black barbershop and says, "Yo, it's your boy Young Lesbian. Let me get that rock." This chapter goes on, and Levon strong arms like a local business owner. And he says, Crawford's eyes narrowed. "But I don't trust you now, brother. That's why I'm here." Levon's eyes suddenly cleared. He smiled wide. "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so," he said. Now Crawford looked confused. Levon's smile never faltered. "It's Shakespeare," he said. "It means you'll have learned to trust me." Crawford laughed, loudly this time. He looked at Levon curiously. "Quoting dead honkies," he twinkled. "You might be useful yet."
Dude, Clara Jeffrey wrote...
Honkies!
She's
honkies!
The ghostwriter here.
Does the word jive turkey appear in this book? Yeah. I have to believe it does.
I like how they specified what everyone's eyes were doing.
Yeah.
That's so
yeah.
useful to me.
Yeah. Fuck, I'm trying to find this one section where like he describes Levon, who's another big, chiseled, strong man with big hands.
Big warm hands.
Yeah. What psychology is going on here that like all the male characters are like 6'3" and Ben's about 5'4"?
Wait, no, like
all the male characters are bears while Ben is a twink.
Yeah, Ben's an otter.
It's an otter.
It's like it's a kosher bear.
No. Ben is a fucking twink. Come on. He can't even raise to the level
of an otter. The difference between a twink and an otter all has to do with smoothness.
Yeah, well, I thought
the
it was
hairier
hair.
You are.
Ben's
is incredibly
hair.
Smooth. There's no
Ben is totally
man
smooth.
Than
smoother than the Kasich boy.
He describes Levon, but who also went to college, so he's like, he's a smart, educated brother. And then like he says, there's some line where Levon is like, he wasn't like the white conservatives that I debated in college. So like Ben inserts himself into this. He's like,
oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Fuck. All right, let me see if I can find this.
He wasn't like the white conservatives I debated. Who, yes, they were a little bit shorter than the average person. They made up for it with their intellect. And when they finally did have sex, it was better that they waited.
It's like that scene from the climactic wrap off from Mr. Show sketch. Where Professor Murder goes, "Damn, this science is too tight."
Okay, so wait, I just want to like, okay, so this chapter ends up with a description of a Detroit cop named O'Sullivan.
Fuck
off.
Patrolling his beat, just wants to get home safe to his wife and kids. I think Ben literally writes that and comes across basically a 10-year-old boy. Hey, pig, it said. The voice wasn't deep. It was the voice of a child. And the kid stood outside the door of the Quick Mart, legs spread, arms hanging down by his sides. A cute black kid wearing a Simpsons t-shirt and someone's old Converse sneakers and baggy jeans.
He definitely hit his head after watching New Jack City in 1991.
Yeah.
And then woke up, because this is some this is a fucking vintage shit. This is not America in 2016.
A cute kid wearing the standard ghetto attire of a Simpsons hooded jacket with Bart Simpson, except Bart is black.
And it has like the like Rasta colors behind it. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's like, fuck off, pig. Don't have a cow, man. That's what the t-shirt said. On his hip, stuck in those baggy jeans, was a pistol. It looked like a pistol anyway, but O'Sullivan couldn't see clearly. And it basically, Ben goes on to describe where like this kid just says, keep saying, fuck you, honky, get out of my neighborhood.
Honky!
Laughing at
a 10-year-old saying honky.
In a Bart Simpson t-shirt and Converse sneakers, tells this cop, fuck off, honky. And the cop, O'Sullivan, is like, put your hands up, I can't, I don't want to shoot you. I don't want to shoot you, kids. And he ends the chapter with this guy gunning down a fucking 10-year-old in the Quick Mart. And then, of course, like, the gun is like it was a toy gun, the tip orange plastic. For a brief moment, O'Sullivan couldn't breathe. When he looked up, he saw them coming, dozens of them, the citizens of Detroit coming out of the darkness, congregating.
Holy
he could feel
shit,
their
dude.
Eyes.
Officer, holding spears with bones through their noses.
Officer Ricky
shouting,
O'Sullivan.
Ooga booga booga. Yeah.
Officer Ricky O'Sullivan sat down on the curb and began to cry. Oh, wait a second. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, Sullivan repeated as he moved towards the body, the smoke rising from his Glock. He pointed it down at the kid again, but the boy wasn't moving. The blood seeped through Homer Simpson's face.
It was Bart, right?
The blood seeped through Homer Simpson's face, pooled around the kid.
Oh my God! Ben!
Pooled
How
around
do
the
you fuck that up? As William Hurt said one time.
The blood the seeped through Homer people. Simpson's face, pooled around the kid's lifeless body. Duh-oh, O'Sullivan thought to himself. No, I just added that. I just added that. That wasn't good. So that was that chapter. Okay, the last thing I want
to
read now.
By the way, that image is supposed to be poignant. This is Ben's idea of poignant. This is also what he actually thinks happened in encounters between black people and the police.
Yeah, get out of here, cracker, said the 8-year-old wearing a Space Ghost coast-to-coast helmet. Officer Potato O'Famine took out his broadsword and beheaded the child. Oh no, he said.
Fuck you, honky, said the youth wearing the McMillan and wife t-shirt.
Blood seeped out of Captain and Tennille's mouth.
The child's last words as his dying breath left him. Nanu, nanu, pig.
The blood pumped out of his femoral artery, just like the pumps on the Populous brand of sneakers he was wearing. I had to jump ahead to the next Levon chapter. And if you thought that like this shit was like the Turner Diaries so far, get a load of this. This is the next Levon chapter. Levon felt the air around him crackle with energy. It was something he had felt before, just before a fight. The switch that went on in his brain that notched the senses higher made him more sensitive, the adrenaline flowing through his veins, the feeling you'd burst from the inside out if the fight didn't commence, and right quick. This is because Levon knew that he wasn't alone this time. It wasn't him taking on some gang rival or him debating some white Republican club sucker at the U. So like I said, this is Ben inserting himself into this narrative. Yeah.
It wasn't getting decimated by his own.
There was going to be flames and blood and the struggle and power. This was going to
what?
Be this
in
is
other
going
words.
This was going to be death and mayhem and hope and glory. This
penetration.
This is a Clash song, by the way. This is going to be fucking big.
So
all
big
Levon
and
needed
hard.
Was the cue. He'd discuss the queue ahead of time with the Reverend. It would come on television during a press conference Big Jim had planned to hold with the mayor in the aftermath of the Kendrick Malone killing. The killing of another young, innocent black man at the hands of the racist white establishment. The police targeting a kid. An unarmed kid, for God's sakes, just because he happened to be black and happened to be out at night at the wrong time. The shooting had worked out precisely according to plan. Levon had one of his boys give little Kendrick a $20 bill to go and harass the cop.
Jesus Christ.
Kendrick, oh my of course, God. Thought it was just a piece of good, clean fun. Messing with white cops was a rare joy. Made you feel like more of a man. And with all the big boys telling him how he'd be a boss in the neighborhood if he baited the cop, he'd been enthusiastic. He probably looked forward to coming home and telling his buddies how he told that cracker-ass pig to go to hell and stared at him right and cursed. Okay, like I said, this book that Ben Shapiro wrote is the fucking Turner Diaries. Yeah. It really is. Yeah, like, is
yeah. No, the Turner Diaries was well written.
Yeah. Yeah, the Turner Diaries had a way more exciting plot. Like, there's nukes and stuff. Yeah.
And again, you know, just to reiterate, in Ben's sick mind, he believes that black communities orchestrate these murders of their own
children.
Children, yeah.
Like, this all works out great for them. Like, what does he think the end game is of this scheme Dude. Is?
They get to buy.
Well, the President Prescott just is like, I'm so sorry your child was killed by the cops. Here's federally subsidized crack cocaine for your neighborhood.
Yeah. We are sorry that this totally unexpected killing happened. We are going to double the deficit in little Kendrick's honor.
I didn't read, but I would bet dollars to donuts there is a moment where President Prescott says, if my son had a friend and he was black, he would look like Kendrick Malone.
Oh, guaranteed. That will happen.
In honor of Kendrick Malone, we are killing the ambassador at the embassy. One white life for one black life. We are going to spread the wealth around. If you like your ambassador, you can keep it.
He just gets all the Obama.
I consider Detroit the 57th state.
All the Obama things in there.
He said as he put the glass pipe to his mouth and filled his lungs with sweet, smoky crack.
Wow, that crack sure gets the taste of a man's dick out of my mouth.
Okay.
This got me so high, I can't wait to kill a fly.
But so I'm so glad we're ending the year on this reading series. I just have two more quick hits from this. This one is from the President Prescott chapter where he argues with the rough and tumble governor of Texas who's called Bubba Davis.
Hell yeah.
And he goes, fuck. I don't have time for this bullshit.
You can't
bullshit.
Fuck with Governor Shithead Malone.
But no, Bubba Davis is a good guy. You know, he's a self-made man who, like, you know, got rich and been making a new kind of oil, Derek.
Is his belt buckle described in this chapter?
No, it's not, because Ben isn't a good enough fucking writer. All
right. Governor Bubba was best friends with the famous conservative writer, the football retard.
So he has an angry phone call with Governor Bubba Davis, who's like, you send me the troops now. I need to secure my border. The cartels are killing people down here. And then
he spits into his spittoon and it makes like a noise. And
then President Prescott says, like, I don't have time for this bullshit, Bubba. You cross me and I promise you'll see the inside of a cell for a very, very long time. Then he hangs up on him. This ends the chapter.
Wait, he's under arrest for wanting to secure his border?
Yeah. He's like, damn it, Governor Davis. If you try to enforce the Constitution, I'll put you in a goddamn cell.
This is exactly like Decker.
Yeah. So he hangs up the phone on Governor Davis, and it says, Prescott buzzed the intercom. Marissa, get me Jazz. That was his nickname for Jasmine Jacks, the national security advisor, his longtime political mentor.
Hell
he,
yes.
He could hear her sexy fingers manipulating the phone.
Sexy fingers.
Valerie Jarrett is like 65, yeah. Dude. the fuck is wrong with you? Valerie Jarrett is like a fucking grandmother.
If you don't fuck as an adult, I guess you just like fetishize the weirdest things.
Yeah.
Oh man, I bet she has all types of nails.
Oh my god. Right.
This is her hair helmet.
Oh
so
god, she bad. Just has the dangly bracelet. Oh.
Okay, this is the last selection from True Allegiance. This is another Brett Hawthorne chapter. And Brett has come across some intel, some documents that are so hot.
The documents? Oh, you're telling me that he has come across documents of importance?
Yeah, he's come across documents that are going to blow the lid off fucking President Prescott. Are you ready for this one? It said Brett knew what it meant. Brett had known of the CIA's discovery of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq for years. Everyone on the inside had known. The media had reported that the government had lied. That somehow all the world's greatest intelligence agencies has been dead wrong. But that wasn't the case. Hussein smuggled some of those weapons out of the country into Syria. Others had been buried in the desert beneath those coordinates. These are the documents. And now they were in Iran.
Hell yes, dude.
Thanks to...
You mean the country that Iraq fought like a 10-year quasi-genocidal war against?
Yeah, that country.
Well, there's a term in Islam.
Of course they're going to give them those weapons. Well, there's
a term in Islam when you fight you pretend to fight a war against another Muslim to fool the kafir.
Sorry, this is the last line of the chapter, the last line I'm going to read from True Allegiance. They were now in Iran. Thanks to Ambassador Beauregard Frederick Feldkopf. Ambassador Beauregard Frederick Feldkopf. Feldkopf, you son of a bitch, Brett muttered. You sold us out.
Damn you, Fauntleroy McGillicuddy.
I can't believe it. I opened up my mission document to secure my assassination target, but Ambassador Stevens Fauntleroy Knickerbocker just is a copy of the Quran. And it says in Arabic, which is what they speak in Iran, it says, what difference does it make?
So, I think True Allegiance is definitely now in the Chapo canon. I want to dip back into this. I need to see where this thrilling narrative takes us.
I think we should. Record.
I am deeply invested in the fate of these characters.
Gotta say, Levon, that's a breakout character.
Yeah. I can't wait till they make a movie of this.
You thought it would be like Colonel Harddick or whatever, but no, he was Levon.
Levon's the best character. Yeah.
Levon put those weapons in Iran.
He's like, I can't wait to blame the war on racism.
This is the perfect example of like how conservatives think like fiction and narratives work, where they just like, you know, these chapters are like the size of a Chinese menu, but in each one of them, they cram in every fucking weird grievance and like mythos that they built up
just
in their head.
Just Wikipedia facts about census tracts. Yeah. It's the worst fucking writing.
You know, this will be our last free episode for 2017. This is our last free episode. So I would like to say, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all my co-hosts, all the former Chapo guests, all the Chapo listeners.
Chanukah.
No, I don't know. Fuck that.
Yeah.
And Kath, to you as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having
me. Happy Ashura, everybody.
And I just want to say, Chapo in 2017 is going to be even bigger, even better. All I got to say is, if you were a fan of the late seasons of The Simpsons, where every week had a new celebrity guest, then... oh boy, we got some fun things in store for you.
Yeah, dude.
And I just want to say, overall, 2016 has been an amazing, awesome year, and 2017 is going to be twice as good. I guarantee
you. You know what I hated about 2015? David Bowie, alive. Prince, alive. Fucking get out of here, dude. Die.
Alan Thicke, alive.
Bullshit, dude. All of my least favorite celebrities died this year. It's been pretty good. My candidate won the presidency. It's been a fucking great year, dude.
Henry Kissinger is still alive.
Yeah, hell yeah.
I was going to say, the only thing that sucked about 2016 is that we lost Antonin Scalia. RIP, brother.
We miss you.
We got a good episode. Until I join you, brother.
Yo, he's in a hot air balloon in heaven right now.
Yeah.
Wearing a lobster costume.
He ate the fucking lobster costume.
He's enjoying 72 pizzas up there.
Yeah. except the great Applebee's in the sky. Yeah. We miss him.
Okay. Choppa, over and out for 2016. Until see you on the other side, boys and girls. We're off to Applebee's.
Salud.
Peace.
Bye.
Bye. Riblets.
So let's remember why exactly people celebrate Christmas. And when we're sitting around our Christmas trees, or you are sitting around your Christmas trees, I want to thank you, Christians, for making this America a Christian country, the best place on earth for a Jew. The only other place in human history that's been like it is Israel now. So thank you for that, and thank you for being part of what makes the country great, even as the left seeks to destroy it and replace the Christmas tree with the pagan notion of what the Christmas tree was.
Don't start the talking. I could talk all night. My mind is sleepwalking while I'm putting the world to right. Calgary's information. Have you got yourself an occupation?
All of us are here to